Welcome to episode 78 of the Infectious Historians Podcast. I'm Merle.
And I'm Lee.
It's September 17th, and in today's episode, we're going to discuss recent work on how to approach disease as a syndemic and how one person documented the COVID pandemic in her hometown. Our guest today is Emily Mendenhall, who is a medical anthropologist and professor in the Science, Technology, and International Affairs program in the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Her forthcoming book on these topics is Unmasked, COVID Community and the Case of Okoboji. The book investigates how people responded to COVID-19 in her hometown in Iowa. Unmasked explores political priorities, cultural squabbles, and business interests that undermined public health efforts when no mandates were put in place.
Emily has published widely in anthropology, medicine, and public health. In 2017, she led a series of articles on syndemics in The Lancet to challenge how we understand concurrent epidemics to cluster, interact, and result from politics, climate, and society. This work was influenced by more than a decade of research about how people perceive, experience, and embody trauma and diabetes through personal stories. And this culminated in the book Rethinking Diabetes: Entanglements with Trauma, Poverty, and HIV. Emily is also the author of Syndemic Suffering, Social Distress, Depression, and Diabetes Among Mexican Immigrant Women from 2012, and Global Mental Health, Anthropological Perspectives from 2015. So hi, Emily, and welcome to the Infectious Historians.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Now, although this podcast is called Infectious Historians, and most of our episodes are about historical diseases, one of the recurring themes in this podcast has been a running comment on COVID in the present, while sometimes drawing parallels with some of the findings and processes we've been seeing in the historical past. In our interview with Emily today, we'll touch upon this recurring theme as we're going to look at COVID's impact on American society on different levels, both from a broader perspective of how Americans have understood and reacted to COVID through some of the common values and ideas in American society and culture, but also at a ground level through a specific case study in Iowa.
Yeah, I think that was a nice way to frame it, Lee. I think we're at a stage in this podcast, as we've said, where I'm excited to talk to people about work that they've done on the ground during COVID and see how they've reacted to the pandemic. For the last year or so, as you said, we've had people reflecting on COVID, and I think people have done a lot of really great work with data and initial responses. But I do think to an extent we're ready for the next phase of this analysis. So this is what got me really excited to talk to Emily to see what interventions have or have not worked and what this means for diseases and pandemics moving forward. But before we chat with Emily, Lee, first of all, it sounds like you're a little under the weather. I hope you don't have COVID.
Yes, I am. And as far as I know, I do not have COVID. We've all been sick. So my daughter started with an eye infection and my spouse developed a throat infection and now I have a throat infection. We actually thought my spouse had COVID for a few days until she got her PCR test, but that came back negative. She was and still is sick. And as you can hear, I'm sick as well. So apologies about the hoarse voice here.
Sorry to hear that, Lee. The other question I have is, I guess, how are your high holidays in Israel? Lots of indoor gathering of everyone to pray?
No, actually not that much. So we spent the two holidays so far out of the three of the high holidays, either by ourselves or with small groups of family members. And by small, I mean probably like up to 10 or so at max. So yeah, it's pretty relaxed. But what about you, Merle? I see you're definitely dressed up with a black tie. So what's that all about?
Yeah, so my wife and I are actually going to an outdoor wedding. I guess it's the first event we've basically done since COVID. The wedding was originally supposed to be, I think, in the fall of 2020. So there's a vaccine and mask mandate for it. So we were okay going to it for at least a little bit. And I guess the other question is for the high holidays is I just watched a Zoom link again of my old shul in New York City, which what they did, I guess, a step above last year when they only had kind of the bare minimum number of people is they did two different shifts of people. So the whole service was condensed into, you know, shorter segments. And then they did one shift and then a second shift later on.
How do they enforce the mask mandate and the vaccine mandate at the wedding?
So I'm quite sure you can't enter the venue without a mask on. I'm not 100% sure how they're obviously enforcing the vaccine mandate per se, but I will say it is, you know, a Northeast blue place that it's happening in with a bunch of upper middle class liberals. And so the chances of people not being vaccinated are probably pretty low statistically. So again, I'm okay with that in that regard. The other thing, speaking of being sick, is my daughter also got a cold after she returned back to school. And I just want to have a brief rant now about the American system and COVID testing, which is to say it's too expensive and there's nowhere to get tested still in the US. So I bought a bunch of these, you know, rapid tests for my house, which ideally you should be doing these multiple times a week, but they're $12 a test. And so there's just no way I'm going to test both my kids, you know, three times a week. It's just not an expense I can afford. But I did do the test, which my daughter came back negative. So that was a positive, I guess.
Yes, that is a positive thing. And what about you, Emily? Where are you and how does COVID look like over there?
Well, it's so interesting to hear about everyone's different experiences. I'm in the DC area. I'm a professor at Georgetown University, and we have a vaccine mandate on campus and a mask mandate on campus. And I teach basically 2.5 classes a semester. So I've been teaching my section of my third class that I teach this month, and it's about 80 students. I, you know, was speaking on Wednesday, teaching on Wednesday. Masked, all my students were masked. There were 80 students, not a spare room, no social distancing, and we had a positive case. So I'm going to get tested, you know, this weekend or Monday. And, you know, I think it's probably fine, but, you know, this happens so much despite the masks and the vaccines. So it's a constant challenge. My kids are in school, so I really want to keep them in school. They're not vaccinated, they're 5 and 8. So, you know, the struggle is real, but also with, you know, I feel so privileged to, you know, besides this, we're doing okay.
So how was Georgetown in the previous semesters? Did you teach in person at all or was it all online?
So last year we were largely virtual. So I taught in the fall and then I actually had my first sabbatical in the spring. It was the first time ever since I have been at Georgetown that I've had a whole semester to just do creative work because I started with a 3-week-old baby. And honestly, the last 8 years have been a complete blur of parenting and writing and doing this work. So I feel like I've come to this kind of peaceful place where I'm trying to say no more and also just, you know, not work at night anymore and just kind of be centered. And I don't know, for academics, it's hard to get there, but I'm trying really hard. So anyway, so I wrote this book on sabbatical and it was this incredible joy to do creative work.
Well, thanks for saying yes to coming on. And I think Lee and I look forward to many years down the road where we can hopefully be in a similar situation and I'm not getting emails from Lee at 2 a.m. from him. But congrats. So if we can turn now to the discussion, and as we always do, we'll start kind of broad and then we'll narrow in. So could you first maybe define for us briefly, if you can, what is a syndemic, since this is something you've worked quite extensively on?
Yeah. When I was doing research for my PhD, I was working at Cook County Hospital for 5 years. And I was working on the study on trauma and, well, actually, it was really on diabetes and access to healthcare and culture and immigration. And I was working mostly with Mexican immigrants. And I was just asking people about their diabetes. And again, trauma was at the center of their stories. Like what people wanted to tell me and how they talked about their diagnosis of diabetes was kind of through this lens of trauma, of early childhood trauma, to the illness diagnosis itself being traumatic. And also, obviously, there's so much disability that comes with advanced diabetes. And many people I worked with were undocumented and really financially strapped. So when I would, you know, go to ask about these kind of clinical questions for the center I was working for, it was so clear that what people wanted to talk about and how people thought about their illness was so much more nuanced and complex. And so when I was doing my research, and then when I was writing my dissertation, I actually had never been introduced to syndemics in graduate school. I was at Northwestern University, which was right near my field site. So I was constantly at Cook County and, you know, kind of between the field and the academy throughout my time there. So it was a really immersive experience. But I wrote a draft of my first 3 chapters of my dissertation. And I really wanted a perspective of someone I, you know, trusted and kind of understood my work. And I sent it to my friend, Kenny Mays, who's a professor at Oregon State, just a brilliant thinker and, you know, just kind person. So he read it and he gave me this feedback and he was like, you are talking about syndemics. And I was like, what are you talking about? And, you know, it hadn't been, I had been thinking about, you know, reading theory of embodiment and kind of more like local biologies and kind of like other kind of theoretical lens to understand what was going on. And so I started reading Syndemics, and it felt like this very engaged ethnographic lens to really make sense of what women were talking about. So anyways, I ended up spending 3 weeks reading anything I could get my hands on. And then I restarted my dissertation. I rewrote everything, but I felt like it was a really engaged and thoughtful way to not just kind of, there's, you know, 10 ways you can talk about the overlap of social and biological experiences, right? Through an anthropological or public health or medical lens. And social epi has pioneered so much of this thinking. But I really think that's what Syndemics does. It really focuses, brings biology in conversation with phenomenology as in a lot of ways in political economy. But what it does is it enables us to speak to a broader audience. So what I've found Syndemics does, which Syndemics inherently is the kind of thinking about the overlap of social and biological experiences through the fact that conditions cluster, you know, looking at multimorbidity, which is like all hot in public health and medicine these days. So looking at clustering of conditions, looking at how they interact. So the psychophysiological, you know, biological, biobehavioral, and even social dimensions of like stigma, how diseases overlap and interact. And then, you know, what drives diseases to cluster? What drives them to interact and what that means? So, you know, working within these three rules made it kind of very clear and an easier way of thinking and a way of communicating across disciplinary boundaries. So really liked engaging in that way. And it made a lot of sense for diabetes and oppression and trauma, because, you know, when I was trying to understand diabetes, really trauma was at the center of how women were talking about it. And there were biological pathways linking trauma and cortisol over many years, you know, especially cumulative trauma to diabetes and, you know, untreated depression and anxiety and PTSD. So it made so much sense for the women I was speaking with and their kind of health realities. So I started working and thinking in that way. And then it kind of, you know, just grew from there.
Right. So that seems like an idea that we have touched upon earlier in this podcast, even though I don't think we've actually called it Syndemics. Where does the idea come from, maybe, and who uses it today? So which disciplines or which kind of practitioners, professionals, experts, where would it be used today?
The architect of Syndemic theory is Merle Singer, who is writing about the complexities of living with HIV. And in the early and mid 90s, this was when a lot of these integrative overlapping theories were starting to be the center of how people thought about social epi, but also biological and cultural anthropology. We have, you know, Margaret Locke writing about interactive of social and biological experiences, Nancy Krieger writing about eco-social theory. You know, we have Lincoln Phelan, we have, you know, all of these really central, and this was also when, you know, social determinants was really building intellectually, but also moving towards kind of broader audiences, getting recognition at WHO. So this was a movement when people were really thinking in this manner of overlap and interaction in different ways. And I think this idea of Syndemics is unique in part because of the way that people engage with it and think with it. So Merle Singer started writing and thinking at the Hispanic Health Council about, you know, what HIV meant with the community he was working with in the inner city. And so, you know, was really writing about, you can't understand HIV without thinking about substance abuse and violence, everyday violence, structural violence, and started writing about the SAVA Syndemic. And I just think how he was framing it was really brilliant. And because he's an engaged anthropologist, it's a way to speak across disciplines. It's a way to communicate and bring people to the table. Especially I found that even talking, you know, especially anthropological theory, if you bring it into a room of physicians, it's just like everything stops. But Syndemics has the depth of theory with a practical element that people can to engage with. What I like is that I can be speaking with a room of physicians and, you know, use kind of speak to their language and also make them critically think about like the political determinants of health. And, you know, obviously it's very, in many cases, can be a bit more narrow than I'd like kind of clinical audiences to think, but it means that they're thinking about it and bringing the idea of this kind of historic complexity of inequality and oppression, and also contemporary political issues to really be thinking about what's crafting what illness means and how diseases interact. And the other thing, the last thing I'll say about it, which is what I really think this kind of Merle's original crafting has done, is really forcing the conversation to think about diseases as never in isolation. And we know with COVID, like COVID is inherently a condition that is interactive, and people really get sick when they experience this interaction. And so, and it's not over only interaction with, you know, inflammation from diabetes or cardiovascular disease, but also from social and political oppression, right? Certain jobs, having to work, you know, struggling to have food on the table, all of these things kind of cascade.
And has it been easy to explain syndemics to a broader public from your experience? And maybe the people that you worked with that you mentioned early on?
Yeah, I think it's been really well received. So I led a series of papers on syndemics in The Lancet in 2017, and it was pretty amazing to see how people picked it up. You know that people are reading it if you get hate mail or like angry mail. And I got like mail from like old white men around the world, pissed that I didn't cite them. And I was like, oh my God, people are really reading this. And that's what kind of my marker of success, like, you know, other people around the world, like people I've worked with, you know, sent really kind messages or like, oh, this is thoughtful, or we should think of this way. But when you have people like pissed about something silly, but I think that people are really engaging with the material in a deep way and have used it. People are really writing about syndemic care, and, you know, and this is work that people in like family medicine have been doing for years. What the kind of idea and theoretical frame or praxis does is it puts people in conversation, which is kind of my interest.
That makes me feel much better about actually our own work if we want to go by that standardly. And also, of course, I like this because of the person's name who came up with it, but we'll put that aside for now. Could I ask, since you briefly mentioned it, has this been used extensively during COVID as well? I mean, this is something that I see mentioned in articles all the time, right? Comorbidities, obviously socioeconomic class has a huge role in who's dying or even just getting sick from COVID. But I haven't actually seen, say, in popular mainstream news, the term used. But have you seen this in maybe more specialist literature extensively?
Yeah, actually, like some business online newspaper or something was using the term syndemics. Like it actually is getting some traction. I mean, it's not, you know, as widespread as like pandemic or epidemic, but I do think it's been interesting because so Richard Horton and I have had a little bit of a tiff in The Lancet ever since we had this series that was published. And it's really interesting because they had a global commission on, it's this brilliant commission actually on the interactions of climate change and food production and over and under nutrition, and how all of these kind of changing global political and ecological factors interact. And they called it a global syndemic. And I was a little enraged because the idea of a global syndemic completely undermines and erases the history of what syndemics do. So syndemics are inherently local, right? Because you can't erase a history of oppression of a people, right? Or the kind of historical legacies of inequality within one country, right? Because that is how we understand why some people get sick and others don't. And by calling it global, it just erases these patterns that syndemics inherently look at. So Merle Singer and I responded to that and said, you know, we have to really think about, yes, there are these interactive global patterns that we have to understand, but syndemics are inherently local because the interactions of conditions are really different from place to place, and context really matters. So fast forward to COVID, you know, Richard Horton has an offline blog that he writes in, and he wrote this blog that said, you know, COVID-19 is not a pandemic, it's syndemic. And then he was talking about how it's global. And so, of course, I responded and I said, you know, it's not global because, you know, context really matters. And I think the best example, although completely different contexts, New Zealand and the United States both have deep histories of settler colonialism and oppression of indigenous peoples, right? COVID-19 is syndemic in the United States, in partly because of white supremacy and historic marginalization, enslavement, genocide that is part of and woven into our history, and also how people experience different conditions. Like we think of the Stroke Belt, how, you know, especially Latino immigrants, Black Americans experience higher rates of cardiovascular disease and other chronic conditions compared to white folks in the U.S., especially if we look at Native reservations in the U.S., where we have such high rates of these conditions that were, you know, putting people at risk for COVID, right? This was at the center of the story, and so much stigmatizing dialogue around that in general. But the reason why COVID was a syndemic was not only because of these patterns that you also see among the Maori in New Zealand, right? This, you know, extraordinary inequality and also oppression in their history, right? The reason COVID was syndemic is because of political determinants, right? Because our leadership denied the reality of the condition and created these cultural and political barriers that prevented us from implementing good policy. I mean, we had a pandemic plan that was completely ignored. And of course, Ardern implemented the plan, closed down the island, obviously totally different geographies and different kind of political stakes. And, you know, it's pretty different. But our experience was inherently syndemic because of these political decisions, not only the kind of patterned inequalities that play out. So I think it's important to think about that. And that's why syndemics are inherently local.
So as you followed COVID, let's say in early 2020 or so, and you knew much of this about the United States already, right? So maybe you didn't really know how the leadership would respond, but all the other variables or many other variables were more or less known. Did this significant death toll in the United States surprise you?
No, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I wrote a piece in Think Global Health in March that was like, this is going to be devastating, right? COVID is going to affect, you know, go on along our kind of fault lines of American society, like we see infections do. I mean, it's going to be unequal. It's going to be an unequal experience in part because of our social policy, right? We are an unequally structured society, right? This is something we see again and again and again. This is how diseases pattern. But what we've seen is something that we would expect, right? The social and biological experiences are not surprising. But I think that what's been amazing about COVID is kind of the racial reckoning and the kind of confrontation of health and racial justice, you know, also climate justice in the US over the last year. And that's one of the reasons why I really wanted to shift my work during this time to think about how white privilege is really playing out in profound ways across the country in COVID denialism. And so I ended up shifting and going, well, we're in quarantine, you know, with two little kids for 4 or 5 months. And then we decided to go to my hometown and quarantine in my parents' basement. They have some bedrooms and a kitchen. And so we usually stay there in the summer when we visit, but they live right next door to my sister who has kids the same age as my kids. And my four-year-old was like using us as her playmates constantly. And so we were like, we need someone for her to play with besides us and her sister. She's going insane. She's very social good. And so we decided, we all got in the car with our dog and we drove out to Iowa in 20 hours, like straight. We stopped to like do cartwheels and go to the bathroom on the side of the road. We brought snacks. And so we ended up quarantining there. And when we arrived, it was in the middle of this big outbreak and no one was masking. Everything was open. It was kind of like COVID didn't exist. And I was just like blown away. A week before we got in our car and made this massive road trip, we had been hiking, you know, out in Maryland somewhere. And we went to a grocery store on the way in. You know, we were masking, we were being super careful. And there were policemen outside of the grocery store policing masks. So you couldn't go in without wearing a mask. And when we got to, we were on I-90 going out towards my hometown and we were in Fairmont, Minnesota. And my eldest, who was 6 at the time, was like about to lose it. And so we had to, you know, get out and like she started doing cartwheels. And my husband went in to get some beef jerky and fill up our car with gas. And he said that when he got in there, the guys running the cash register were like, oh, where are you headed? And he was like, he was wearing a mask. And he was like, oh, I'm going to Okoboji. And they're like, oh yeah, you going there to party, bro? And my husband was like, no, like that is not what I'm doing right now. It was just like, nothing was real. Like what everyone else was experiencing was just not present. There was no pandemic. And we were just like, oh God, what is going on? And so we got there and my brother-in-law led the COVID response in Okoboji in Dickinson County. He was masterful. He did this incredible job. But he was really facing an uphill battle. And really his only arsenal was Facebook messages. Like he had no power. Public health had absolutely no power. It was all with the county supervisors who were really reluctant to instate any sort of regulation. So it was just a huge challenge. So I ended up just interviewing everyone I went to high school with. And it was really fascinating.
So I think you've nicely described kind of different reactions and what it looked like in DC versus Iowa. But what was maybe the most surprising thing you found aside from the general complete difference in how people were thinking about the pandemic?
Well, thought was really interesting because I'm like really into yoga, and a lot of my friends I've kind of kept in touch with are also into yoga. And so I kind of dipped my feet into the wellness community, as well as, you know, basically everyone I went to high school with and then anyone they put me in touch with. But when I was speaking to my friend, so there's a huge chiropractor community there. A lot of, there's like 4 yoga studios. It's a tourist area. So also, you know, there was this collective turn in May, which you could almost feel viscerally, which I found to be so fascinating, from COVID to the economy, because so many people depend on these 3 months to make money to live the entire year. So that was something that was really interesting to observe. It was like this about face. And what was so interesting though, I think a lot about fear, partly because I've been studying interpersonal violence for a really long time. And people always talk about fear and anger and kind of all these deep emotions. So I can't like help asking about it. But, you know, when I would talk to some of my friends who are in that kind of community, I'd be like, well, are you scared of coronavirus? Are you worried about your health or getting it? And well, a lot of people would say, I don't fear coronavirus because I believe in God. There was this deeply cultural kind of response, but also people were like, you know what? I'm healthy. Like, if you're sick, stay home. Why should I fear? One woman I asked, will you talk to me? And she like owns a athletic studio in the area. She's ride my bus on the way to school when I was a kid. And I was like, do you mind speaking to me about COVID? I'm just like interviewing a bunch of people. And she's like, oh, well, I've heard you've been interviewing people. And I think I'm not going to talk to you because I choose mental health over coronavirus. I was like, well, that's not like really a choice you can make. Like, you can't just like, you know, that's not how it works. But I was like, okay, that's fine. But that was kind of this kind of idea of, you know, I need to let go of my fear because I can't live in fear. And so because of that, I'm going to maybe wear a mask when I'm around someone who I find is fearful, or I'm going to wear a mask if I know someone will be sick. But every other part of my life, I'm going to act normal because that will give me some sort of centering. And, you know, Lenore Manderson and Susan Levine wrote about this in like an early piece that I think has been like cited really, really profoundly across disciplines about fear and risk in March of 2020. And they wrote something just at the end of their piece that really resonated. And I cited in the book, but that just basically said, because of white privilege, some people will feel that they don't need to take stock of the virus. They don't need to respond to the pandemic. And I think that's what we saw in America. Like, I think that was so deeply sodden in why people rejected COVID. And I mean, we look at the death rates, which are uneven. And, you know, people have, you know, in this rural town where I grew up, there is really pretty good healthcare. You know, there's a pretty strong safety net, and people could access testing if they wanted to, although a lot of people didn't because they had symptoms and they're like, well, it's fine. Some people did quarantine, and there was this gray area that I found was fascinating because, you know, nothing is black and white, right? Nothing's all or nothing. And most people I spoke with, specifically Trump supporters, I spoke to a lot of Trump supporters who, some of them were just like staunch anti-maskers. And, you know, also there was this really interesting kind of overlap with really religious anti-mask, anti-vax mothers who were, AJ Sobel writes about this, I think really nicely in her work on vaccine hesitancy, but almost all with kind of lefty white moms in California somewhere. But she's written about how, you know, women use this vaccine hesitancy kind of label and narrative to build social power and garner some sort of local prestige and power and voice. And I found that's actually very similar in some ways in Okoboji, but instead it's like, it's all about social power. Everything's about social power, but it's mostly pretty Trumpy, really far right, but also Earth Mama community, like women who I found were really interesting. And like some of the women who were perpetuating vaccine hesitancy, one of them owns a yoga studio. And she was actually giving out like information about vaccine hesitancy to people who were taking her classes. And her husband is the pastor of a church. And they were promoting this like whole, basically kind of devising social power from this insider knowledge. And this is something we see again and again in how people promote conspiracy. And so, you know, conspiracy comes from, you know, the radio, from Alex Jones or wherever you hear it, but then people claim that knowledge and perpetuate this again and again and create their own following at the local level. And this was also perpetuated by a local physician. So I've seen a few people writing about this, and I write about it pretty extensively in the book, but there was a local physician who was basically part of this church, part of this kind of anti-vax community that was perpetuating all of this conspiracy So when my brother-in-law was like doing this education and all the physicians were being really careful and, you know, a large portion of the nurses also were getting wearing masks and being really careful, although there were also a bunch of nurses that were like pretty visibly and outspokenly at bars and like taking selfies. But this one physician created all of this harm because he kept saying, you know, COVID isn't that bad. You don't even have to mask. Actually, a friend of mine emailed me because he told her grandmother, who had kidney problems and diabetes, was 83, that she didn't have to mask or worry about COVID because it was behind us. And this was in August of 2020. And so that's when things really started to heat up there. And then the last part of the book is really about school boards, you know, local school boards are where like politics throw down. So it was really interesting to observe how people talked about like liberty and freedom and what numbers mean.
Were there any attempts by NGOs or some other local organizations to make the opposite argument that people should mask, that people should care about COVID? Or was this only done by the public health authorities and maybe some of the doctors and so on?
So it was really interesting because in Dickinson County, which is a largely tourist area, it was largely just public health. There were some businesses that were closing down, doing curbside pickup, masking. You could go in a select number of businesses and they would have masks and shields and gloves and being really careful and thoughtful and also having masks and hand sanitizer when you came in. And that was maybe like five businesses that I can think of, maybe a few more. So there's a longtime legislator who was just beat out, Steve King, who's like a white supremacist. He's been documented as so and called that by the Washington Post. He was elected in this county for 21 years. So this is kind of representing the extreme beliefs. And one of his biggest donors actually owns, I think it's 8 businesses in the area. And he actually forbade his staff to talk to me. He said he wouldn't talk to me. But I'd already talked to a number of his staff who actually said they forbade masks. Even when they were exposed or had a positive case, they were forced to go back to work earlier. You know, there were a lot of really, before their quarantine was over, you know, there were a lot of really complicated things that were happening that I was listening to and hearing. And then, you know, also talking to my brother-in-law about saying like, I'm hearing this. And he's like, yeah, I know about that. You know, he was really on top of it. He was really engaged at the community level. He's really beloved. And also people joke about him. Oh, the guy who looks like Lin-Manuel Miranda. It's really funny. But he just was like on top of it. He was basically on Facebook constantly bringing down conspiracy and myth and fear and just responding to people. And he really felt like that was his most powerful arsenal. But he was confronted with this strong business community that was pushing for a normal summer. And it wasn't a normal summer. There were definitely lower numbers of people visiting. And but if you went out to the bars, it would feel like any summer. They were packed. People were unmasked. You know, restaurants were open. After there was a big outbreak in the beginning of June when I first got there. And after that, one really nice, kind of the one of the nicer restaurants shut down for 2 weeks because they had 2 positive cases of people who worked for them and then opened up and everyone was masked. And there were a few other restaurants that did a great job. They're open the whole time, but they had socially distanced tables. Everyone was masked. And at the time you had to have 50% capacity and, you know, most restaurants weren't doing that and they were fined like $1,000, but it felt like a pretty normal summer.
So can I ask if what seemed to you be the most effective way was, you know, Facebook responses? Is there anything that can be done beyond kind of an ad hoc response that way in terms of approaching, you know, places like this to change how people are doing things, or is there kind of no hope at all?
Well, I think like policy matters. And, you know, I think the really fragmented red state, blue state response was harmful. I think it was really harmful. And I think the fact that the global health security agenda, you know, was shut down in 2018 was also really harmful. There was inherently a pandemic preparedness plan that we could institute and release. The national stockpile had also been depleted by the time the pandemic happened. So the messaging was off. People didn't know what to believe. So a lot of this conspiracy comes from the top, right? Things, you know, unravel piece by piece, person by person. And because there was such unclear messaging, that I think the conspiracy at the local level got really out of control. I think that locals can have some sort of control, but there has to also be some sort of leadership and coherent response. A lot of people have written about like the leadership in Rwanda, the leadership in New Zealand, about what compassionate and trusted leadership looks like and what it means to foster trust among in your country, why people trust your leadership and how. You know, how do people lead in a way that makes you think that you have their best interest and their health in mind? And I think the constant denialism at the top was so harmful and played out in these deep ways. But there's also really nuanced cultural dimensions of settler colonialism and these ideas of manifest destiny, which are false, but these ideas that, like, especially Western Iowans and people living further west have really powerful beliefs of small governments and them not interfering, even though many, many people rely on agricultural subsidies to survive. People deny that the government should have a role in their life. And so even in these like school board meetings, this idea of like, well, I believe in personal freedom and liberty and the government should tell me what to do. These narratives can be discussed in certain ways so people feel like they have some power, because people do have a lot of power because the government has very little authority in these ways. But I mean, kids still wear pants to school. You know, how people talk about what is right and what is safe can be framed in different ways. So I think it was a huge problem of messaging from the top, from the beginning.
So given the problems with the messaging that you've mentioned, how easy is it to kind of fix this after COVID has started, after the messaging has been problematic at the beginning? Can you kind of flip people back? Can you get them on the right track after they lost confidence in, let's say, the state or state's institutions and so on?
Everyone wants a quick fix, right? Like my students are always like, oh, well, what's the solution? You know, how do we fix it? And I think that things are actually just going to get harder. So I think there are some ways to get us on the right track. So building trust in institutions, like providing childcare for the kind of childcare legislation, like providing childcare so people know that their families can grow and they can have support from the state, and starting to trust in basically state institutions again, that's one thing. I also wonder what the infrastructure bill will do, like really investing in green infrastructure and thinking about shaping what things look like in the future, because I think building trust has to start from the ground up. And it's not going to happen on Facebook. I think Facebook has created so many problems and they're too slow to respond that they create so much conflict. I don't know what the solution is there, to be honest. Like, they keep saying, you know, well, we're responding, we're doing this, we're doing that. And it's just so slow. You know, when people would speak about COVID, they'd be like, well, they said on, or, you know, I read that, she posted that. And that was constant. Like, it is this sub-communal level of dialogue that is fascinating. And I spent a ton of time on Facebook. I actually almost deleted my account before COVID because I like never used it. And then I was like, oh my gosh, good thing I didn't delete my account, because there's the only way I communicate with like the kids I grew up with. And I found out that everyone was on it all the time. So even when I left, I was closely monitoring a number of accounts. Oh, and partly to kind of follow the nuance, I had started talking about something and got distracted that, you know, a lot of the really committed Trump supporters were also really conflicted. And so when I mentioned earlier that things weren't just, you know, extreme right and extreme left, you know, there were some really strong Trump supporters that were nurses, for example, that were like really pissed at their community and like stopped talking to friends because they were such anti-maskers, for example, because they really believed in the science. So I really think the messaging, if you're going to get through to people, is finding people who are safely standing on middle ground and are open to those communications, and then leading those communications. So there's like trust at the top and at the bottom. Like, so building trust by building stronger institutions, rebuilding roads and bridges. That's what I can think of, you know, really having the government trust, or people trust in what the government is and like see it in a visual way. I think that's really powerful. But then also building in communal trust by having people who really believe in science, who are still on the far right, lead these conversations.
So it's basically, I mean, at least the first part is really reestablishing or rethinking the social contract, right, between the state
exactly.
and its citizens.
Yeah.
Then the second part would be to politicize this entire conversation by, I mean, trying to break down the Democrat, Republican, left and right silos. And as you just said, you do believe in the science, but also hold, in this particular case, right-wing ideas.
Yeah. And I really hope people read Unmasked, because when I thought about writing it, I felt like, you know, I have known the people I write about in the book my entire life. A few people I met kind of through the course of the study, but most of the people I've known my whole life. And so, you know, I kind of get where they're coming from and where these intense kind of in-groups and out-groups are. And so I start with, like, you know, the dislocation of the Dakota and the U.S. Dakota War, right? And how people came to live there and how, you know, many people believe, I mean, they believe that that land is theirs and they fought for it. And, you know, even though you had to be white and male to get the 1.25 acre of land, you know, in the 1800s, right? So why did people get land and when and where? I mean, that is even a myth that's been reconstructed, right? So how people believe in their existence and, like, ownership. And, you know, a lot of people in my community where I'm from, you know, were lost land and their whole identity during the farm crisis of the 80s. So people have kind of reconstructed their identity in the community again and again. But I think that's also solidified these in-groups and this kind of insularity that, you know, a lot of people call it a bubble or, you know, this, like, landmass or this, like, special kind of space that's separate from anywhere else. And that's also somewhat kind of a cop-out for just saying, like, a white exceptionalism, right? Like, we don't have to worry about other things. We live in a bubble. Like, this is our community. This is how we are. And we as being very exclusionary and exceptional, right? And it kind of underscores the myth of white exceptionalism within this community when people didn't even care for their neighbors, right? So what does the social fabric actually look like? And unfortunately, a lot of that conflation was played out in every day. And it's actually one of my favorite comments by one of the public health advisors when I was like, well, what's it like? Like, what kind of calls do you get? And, like, there were some grandmas who were calling in and they're like, Karen down the street keeps coughing on my tomatoes. You know, and it was just so funny, the kind of, like, narratives and the community level dialogue that people bring, you know, to the conversation. And, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity for learning in this moment. But I was just interviewed for a brief podcast for Scientific American. And the guy who interviewed me was like, I just don't get why people aren't wearing masks. And I was like, you can't, it's just not an easy answer. You know, there's just not, like, you just asked me, like, what's the solution? There's not an easy solution. These are wicked problems, right? They're big social problems. They're not easy. But I do hope that Unmasked sheds a little bit of light on where people were coming from and the fact that even people who are staunch anti-maskers also would be, like, on the side, they'd be like, yeah, but then my dad got COVID and he almost died. And I was really worried about him. You know, it's like, well, probably people told you to wear a mask, you know, or a woman was like, you know, my kid has had pneumonia 9 times. And, like, I don't want her to wear a mask at school because I don't really believe in masks, but I'm kind of worried about her getting sick. There are all these kind of, besides the kind of belligerent divisions within our culture, there's really powerful nuance that people are grappling with in their hearts and minds, you know?
And I think these stories really humanize the individuals that we tend to just see on either the news or on Facebook. And we're much more distant from these people otherwise.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So one thing you've kind of mentioned throughout this discussion, that's something that I'm particularly curious about, and maybe the school board angle that you mentioned might be the way to discuss this briefly, is the idea of kind of individual liberty and, you know, collective public good. And so how did you see that kind of playing out during maybe some of the school board meetings or other settings? And are there ways in which, you know, as we've just suggested, that there we could possibly rebuild a more coherent social fabric moving forward?
So these ideas of liberty and freedom, obviously the words, way people use them and enact them in conversation and, you know, everyday speak has changed over the last 2-3 decades. That's a fact. But I also think this kinds of ideas of rugged individualism are at the heart of how people see themselves. I know that's, like, a trope, but it is kind of this, like, notion of, you know, how people see the self in their community. Like, we do not need outsiders. They are very insular. Someone introduced me this summer when I was visiting my family. They're like, oh, you're the one who left. But I think she said that. I was like, oh my God, I am the one who left. You're right. You know, I'm not in group. Although, you know, I kind of was in the in group because, you know, my family's been there for 5 generations. You know, my dad's on the city council. My brother-in-law led the COVID response. My sister runs a small organic farm. You know, my mom volunteers for, like, 30 organizations because she's a citizen scientist. She's been, you know, monitoring the water for 40 years to see how you know, the health of the lake has changed. You know, this is the community that, you know, is part of my family, but, you know, being the one who left is kind of isolating. I thought it was really interesting, but I think these notions of what it means to be part of this community, it is very actually kind of conservative values in general. I mean, these ideas of we will help, if you're part of our group, we will support you, right? Like there are no safety nets from the government. Even a right-wing legislator I talked to, he said, we have to open the economy. We don't have any safety nets. If people don't work, they don't eat. And I was like, scribbling in my notes, because I was like, well, obviously if there was a safety net, we could all, you know, support each other and come together and build this, you know, actually quarantine or whatever, which I thought was fascinating. But, you know, where the safety nets are really filled is by religious organizations. People are very religious. So this kinds of ideas of individualism and liberty are really about kind of supporting kind of group ideas. And, you know, this whole idea that God will protect me, God will protect us. We are protected and we are special is, you know, at the center of a lot of how people were thinking about COVID and why I think people didn't think they needed masks.
Since I'm a historian, I just have to ask out of curiosity, have you seen these notions of, you know, individual liberty, freedom, and, you know, social safety nets, have these changed within the area you grew up over the lifetime that you remember, at least? Is this something that's become more and more pronounced over time, or has it kind of always been there since you can remember?
Things have absolutely changed in the last 30 years, in part because of the foreign crisis. It really changed the community and also the makeup of what people did and people's identities. Like in most parts of Iowa, people work on farms, either as laborers, as fewer and fewer families own farms. So people make money off the farm, but in Okoboji, it's the lake. You know, and intensely, I also wrote this little piece that I don't know if I'm going to publish, but it's about my family and about tourism. So my great grandmother and her husband were from Des Moines, and they went up in 1906 and 1907, and they camped around the lake. At the time, they had just decided not to build the railroad on the west side of the lake. So there's this man they knew from Des Moines who was trying to sell off some land real cheap. So they ended up buying this little plot of land on the west side of the lake, and they built a cabin there. Her parents were carpenters, and she was actually a physician, which I'm very proud of. She was a pretty special person. And she did mental health research, which I do too. So also very, very neat. But her parents were carpenters. So they came and they built this little cabin. And her parents loved it so much, they bought another piece of land right next to it, and they built a little cabin. And eventually they had bought all these little pieces of land at that time and built these little cabins. And it ended up that their son, I only had one kid, my grandpa, ended up building a few more cabins and running them as a little family resort for his work. That was his life's work. And so, you know, my dad grew up there, and, you know, I grew up there. And although tourism has always been part of the community and development has always been part of the community, I think that there was a critical turn. I mean, the rise of neoliberalism touched everything, right? And the deregulation of our waterways, how money could be spent, what could be developed, all of this played out in very local ways, right? In Okoboji, we saw it through the development and basically use of the lake as green, right? How much money can you make on the lake? Now you can have a boat in one of the marinas and call in the morning and say, I'm going to fly in on my private jet, get my boat ready for me. I'm going to go and have a joyride, get back in my private jet. The marina will put the boat away and I'll fly home. That happens. Especially in the 80s and 90s, a lot of families that had owned like a summer cottage for generations lost those, and they were bought up by really, really wealthy people who were making all of this money in the 90s, and they started building these mega mansions that's only intensified. So actually throughout this last summer, it's interesting, my mom, who's a citizen scientist and really into conservation, started this project with my sister, because everything is a family affair, called the Century Cottages Project, where they're actually making plaques for every cottage that's 100 years old to basically promote preservation and not have to, you know, rebuild. And, you know, every time you rebuild on the lake, you affect the cleanliness of the lake. Anyway, along with all of this development of homes, there have been these development of condominiums. And, you know, now there's this person I talk about quite a bit in the book, the businessman I was talking about earlier, who has basically been using the lake to make so much money. He's built an empire. And he like brings these big boats, party boats on the lake, and it's super loud. And you know, my high school reunion was supposed to be on one of those party boats, and I am like chronically late, and I got there 2 minutes late and I missed it. I was like, oh my God. But you know, this is what people do. It's like people party on the lake, and you know, there are just so many people who are on the lake constantly. And part of the book also is about what I call COVID Bay, which is Miller's Bay, this bay right in front of where my grandparents settled, where they started to party. So on the weekends, all these boats fill up the bay, and it's actually a breeding ground for a number of fish. So this is a little article that I wrote about, is this link between like my family and like knowing this bay so well and these waters so well. But 20 years ago, this guy actually who I grew up with, he's like a rocker now. He's like, you know, Damon Dotson. He's, you know, really popular. And he puts on this big party on the lake every 4th of July. And so people started coming to this party, which looked a really fun idea. And there's a no wake zone in part to protect the aqua or the breeding grounds and these like precious ecologies. But what's happened now is like not during the party, people go and tie up there. And there's so little regulation, and the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, isn't breaking them up, that it's actually killing some of the breeding grounds. And they started doing some research. I think one time there were 3,500 people on, I don't know how many boats in the bay on like a Saturday afternoon, which is a lot of people. There's like so much poop and pee and garbage after the weekend in the lake that it's actually killing the natural environment, which is kind of a good example for like what we've seen to the planet, right? So when I think about Miller's Bay and I think about my community, I think about the toxification based on making money and exploiting these natural resources that we see around the world. So it's like everything. It's a microcosm for the world and what we're seeing. And, you know, partly this rejection of COVID was actually rejection of crisis and the actual reality of the moment that we're in. So it's complex, right? There's no easy answer, but I think just understanding where we are as a planet and a community and a society is so critical right now.
Yes, and I think that is actually a very good place to conclude this interview. So thanks so much, Emily, for coming on the podcast and sharing some of your research and personal stories with us.
Thank you so much. It's such a privilege to share this space with you.
Thank you so much. So I thought that was a great interview, Lee, because right from the start, she reminded us quite clearly that scale, certainly geographically, matters quite a bit, right? That we think maybe globally or nationally when it comes to pandemics, and I guess Israel is different from the United States in this regard to an extent, but that at least here, where you were at various stages of this pandemic has really driven a lot of different responses. And this is what I think her point was about syndemics.
Yes. And I think that actually does connect to a lot of what we've been doing. I mean, almost intuitively in this podcast, right? And just the weekly or the biweekly, really going over what is going on in each of our different locations. I mean, it really does emphasize the local over the national or international or any such larger level of scale, I guess. Now, one of the things that struck me as we interviewed Emily was this entire experience of coming back or moving back or visiting your hometown or a place where you belonged a long time ago. And I mean, my sense from her was that, again, she changed, that place has not changed as much. And that's definitely a feeling I can identify with.
Yeah. Are you thinking particularly of you leaving Israel for a long time and then coming back, or something more specific within Israel?
Yeah, so it's both. It's both Israel, but also, I mean, even Hebrew University, right? So this is a place I went to as an undergrad, and I came back as a faculty member, and some things are the same and other things have changed. My perspectives have definitely changed, some for the better, I guess, some for the worse. But yeah, it's an interesting experience that, again, I could identify with.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I left New York, you know, before college and haven't really been back. But it's definitely very different than when I grew up, we'll leave it at that. And, you know, its reaction, obviously, to COVID is different than where I am, and other places are similar in that regard. So on that note of maybe some nostalgia, Lee, have you been watching anything recently that, you know, you would recommend to our listeners or maybe recommend they avoid listening to?
Yes, so I have watched a movie. The movie is called The Girl with All the Gifts. It's a zombie movie. And the premise there is that there's a zombie apocalypse and some children, I won't say how they got these children, but some children are something between zombies and people. So they're being protected within this school military base or whatever. And the movie really concentrates on this one girl, again, the girl with all the gifts, and her story within this world.
You and zombie apocalypse movies, they seem to be your favorite these days.
Yeah, so if you remember, I taught a class on this last semester, in the fall semester of last year, so a year ago. And this is one of the papers that is like a seminar paper here. You get like an entire year to work on it. So one of the students wrote on this particular movie, which I haven't watched before. And so I decided to simply watch the movie as part of my prep to grade his paper. So what have you watched? I'm assuming you're not watching any movies for classes or for grading class papers. So what have you been watching other than The Bachelorette, that is?
Actually, it's been Bachelor in Paradise, Lee. You should know this. But in any case, we finally finished up the last shortened season of Madam Secretary, which was one of these kind of feel-good political shows about a female secretary of state. And then in the last season, she becomes president.
Okay. Is it supposed to be based on someone specific?
Not really, I think, at the beginning. I mean, maybe one could say Hillary Clinton to some extent, but it's supposed to be kind of a apolitical, independent person. And as these shows go, they always solve all the world's crises basically by the end. So it's also quite funny, right? Because it's a foreign secretary, so you have to solve foreign problems. So by the end, you've like checked off every country in the world that you've like almost solved all the world's issues. So it becomes kind of funny in that regard. But on a serious note, why I found it interesting, I mean, we slowed down, we watched a few seasons and stopped, and a few more seasons and stopped. But it definitely has, if I recall, a pre-Trump era and then a Trump era version of the show, which is very different, right? In terms of its messaging, in terms of its approach to foreign policy, in terms of its politicization and its direct confrontation of issues.
If I remember correctly, you were always pretty big on political TV series, right? I mean, you like these definitely more than I did.
Yeah, I would say I've watched most of them, yeah.
Which one is the best? The most realistic based on your experience in DC?
I mean, none of them are realistic. I mean, House of Cards at least has discussions of voting and whip counts and that kind of stuff. I mean, it gets it horribly wrong, but at least has that, I guess one could say. The rest of them, I mean, West Wing is like a liberal fantasy, which again does have some discussions of these points. So I guess that has some realism. And the writers on it, I believe, were former Clinton speechwriters, if I recall. And that's why in the West Wing, the communications people, which is what the people who wrote the show were, have like such a central role as opposed to like the policy people.
What's your take on Scandal?
I mean, that's an absurd show. I did watch most of it, though, I will say.
Fair point. Yeah, I just couldn't watch it after four episodes. It was just hilarious.
I mean, the problem with Scandal is the problem of a lot of shows, I would suggest, which is they go so extreme in the first season or two with so many different twists and turns that by like season four or whatever, what do you have left to do? Right? I mean, this is also the critique famously of anything after the first two seasons of The OC. If you ever watched The OC, like,
no.
That's an important, wonderful show that is generational and you should watch it. I highly recommend.
Okay. I guess we can at least agree on Scandal, though. Okay. So on this note of covering TV shows and political TV shows from Roll and maybe zombie apocalypse movies for myself, we can conclude this episode. And again, as usual, we'd like to thank our sponsors at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and the team producing this podcast, our sound editor, Amitai Bar-Lavi, and our webmaster, Verder Kanati.
Until next time, stay safe, get vaccinated if you can, and maybe send Lee some non-zombie apocalypse movie suggestions.